It's the Underpod with your host, Quentin Copeland.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to week two, episode two of the Underpod. We here are still and forever will be Team David in the constant struggle between the world's Davids and the world's Goliaths. Today we have a bit of an interesting topic chosen for all of y'all. It is heavily influenced by who our guest today is, the baseball lifer and head of the AAA associate for the Red Sox, the Worcester Red Sox, Dr. Charles Steinberg, joins us today to talk about his beloved Orioles, which he grew up rooting for, and their unlikely 1966 World Series, while also touching on a couple of other underdog stories that involve the Orioles without them necessarily being the star of the show. The 1966 Orioles were, for a team at the time, brand new to their environment. They had only a decade prior moved out to Baltimore from St. Louis, where they were the St. Louis Browns. They shifted back to the American League and became the Baltimore Orioles and had a tough time getting it going, but the 60s proved different than the 50s. In 1966, they won 97 games, only losing 63, and finished a whopping 9 games up on the runner-up Twins. So they won the American League in a landslide. That year, they played at Memorial Stadium, and they were managed by Hank Bauer. The big three for the O's on offense was first baseman Boog Powell, third baseman Brooks Robinson, and right fielder Frank Robinson. Frank Robinson won AL MVP that year and World Series MVP. Brooks Robinson won the All-Star Game MVP and a Gold Glove. The rest of their starting lineup in the field was rounded out by catcher Andy Etchebarren, second baseman Davey Johnson, Gold Glove shortstop Luis Aparicio, left fielder Kurt Blefary, and center fielder Paul Blair. Their rotation wasn't too shabby either. The top three was 23-year-old Dave McNally, 22-year-old Jim Palmer, and Wally Bunker to round out a very, very, very solid and young, exciting rotation. Their bullpen was solid top to bottom with hardly an ERA above 4 registered by any of their main pitchers. But their bullpen was headlined by three individuals, Stu Miller, Mo Drabowski, and Eddie Fisher. In the 1966 World Series, they faced the big mighty Dodgers, sweeping them 4-0 in a huge underdog upset. It was a tightly contested series, so much so that the last two games, including the clincher, were just mere 1-0 wins for the Orioles, as they won their very first World Series title as an organization. That brings me now to my guest, Dr. Charles Steinberg. Dr. Steinberg, it's great to talk to you again. I know you are phoning in from your class at Emerson College in Boston. Would you just, for the listeners, introduce yourself, let them know who you are, what you do, and really establish your credentials as not only an Orioles fan, which I know a lot about your history with that organization, but your history in everything, life, baseball, work, whatever it may be.
Yes. So I'm Dr. Charles Steinberg, Director of Sports Communication at Emerson College and President of the Worcester Red Sox, in a most unlikely career that also includes being a dentist. And it's a career and a life that started in Baltimore. And growing up in the 1960s as a child in Baltimore, the Orioles were the best. They were great teams, great people. They gripped the city. That continued into the 70s. And imagine my joy when at age 17, this Baltimorean got to have an internship with the Orioles. And that lasted 19 years till I chose to go and follow the mentor, follow the teacher, Larry Lucchino, when he took over the San Diego Padres.
Yes, I've heard the stories about you and Larry and your role in building Camden Yards, Petco Park, and now Polar Park for the Worcester Red Sox. So I guess to start us off here, our topic today being the baby Baltimore Orioles of 1966, can you take us through what made that team so special?
The Baltimore Orioles were born as, or reborn as, a major league team when St. Louis's other team, not the Cardinals, but the Browns, moved to Baltimore in 1954. The St. Louis Browns were notorious for being one of the least productive, that's a euphemism, one of the losingest teams there was. And so the 1954 Orioles were terrible. They made a gigantic trade. What was it? 17, 18 players, the largest trade in the history of baseball, because they just had to start from scratch. And by 1960, they were interesting. This is before I was following them. By 1964, they were in the thick of the pennant, but they didn't win. And remember, there's no playoffs. You either finish first in your league or you go home. And in 1966, it all changed. They acquired a former National League MVP, 10 years with the Cincinnati Reds, because Cincinnati thought Frank Robinson was an old 30. And Frank Robinson came to Baltimore, joining Brooks Robinson, no relation, although they joked about it. And Frank Robinson and Brooks Robinson teamed up to lead the Orioles to the American League pennant. And Baltimore went wild, but everybody knew that the royalty of baseball was the Los Angeles Dodgers, their opponent in the World Series. The Brooklyn Dodgers had only won one World Series ever, 1955. And when they broke Brooklyn's heart and moved to Los Angeles, they not only moved to L.A., they started winning World Series. They won in 59. They won in 63. They won in 65. And so, of course, the fledgling underdog Baltimore Orioles had no chance in the World Series against the gaudy, beautiful Hollywood Los Angeles Dodgers. Would you like to know what happened then?
Yeah. Yeah, I would.
Los Angeles and the Dodgers were so sure that with the greatest pitcher in the game, Sandy Koufax, and his fabulously successful teammate, Don Drysdale, they were going to win. So much so that when the Orioles landed in Los Angeles, there was a billboard in L.A. that said, "Would you believe four straight?" And in game one, there was Don Drysdale. And in the first inning, Frank Robinson hits a home run. Brooks Robinson hits a home run. And the Orioles go on to win game one. Game two in Los Angeles, I believe that was the day that 20-year-old Jim Palmer became the youngest pitcher ever to throw a World Series shutout. So now it's 2-0. And they land in Baltimore, where someone put up a billboard, "Would you believe four straight?" And young Wally Bunker throws a shutout too. And now the Orioles are up 3-0. And on a mysteriously historic October 9th, 1966. Dave McNally, the game one starter, is pitching again. Throws a shutout. Frank Robinson hits a solo home run that will be the only run of the game. Mystery number one, no one knew that there was a six-year-old boy in the stands watching that. And the six-year-old boy got to go to the game because his dad worked for the Orioles in the minor leagues. And that's when the six-year-old fell in love with baseball. That's when the six-year-old said, that's what I want to do. That six-year-old was Cal Ripken Jr. The day the Orioles shocked the baseball world as the underdogs beat the Los Angeles Dodgers was the day that Cal Ripken fell in love with baseball. Me? I was 7, almost 8. I hadn't yet fallen in love with baseball. I hadn't followed that whole story. But the moment that Paul Blair caught that last out in center field and Brooks Robinson leaped into the air with the joy of winning the World Series and a dream, a lifelong dream had come true, my mother, now of blessed memory, said to my sister and me, get in the car. We're going downtown. And she accurately predicted a spontaneous, safe, civic celebration on the streets of downtown Baltimore. My dad was happy we won, but it was my mother who told my sister and me to get in the car. And we went downtown, and the horns were blowing. The streamers were flying. People were hugging. Baltimore exploded in ecstasy and joy. And for this 7-year-old, I had never seen anything like it. And we got out, my mother parked, we got out of the car, and she bought me a white flannel Orioles pennant. And she wanted to make sure it was one that said world champions. And some big kid, like 14 years old, saw a guy in a suit getting into a taxi cab right outside all of the Baltimore hotels. They were right there. And he said to me, get his autograph. And I get his autograph. I don't know who anybody is. Well, it turned out to be Harry Walker, who had been a star 20 years earlier, long before I was born. I'm 7. And would be a big league manager. He said, get his autograph. There's another guy getting in a taxi. And that was Alvin Dark, another good major leaguer who would go on to be manager of the world champion Oakland A's. But these were day games, and representatives of different clubs were hurrying up, checking out of their hotel, getting in taxis, and heading to the airport because they wanted to catch their flights home. That's why they were all getting in taxi cabs in downtown Baltimore. Me? I'm watching the unplanned circus. That day, Cal Ripken Jr. fell in love with the action. I fell in love with the reaction. And many years later, long after Cal and I had been proverbial teammates, actually literal teammates at the Baltimore Orioles, did I learn that that was the day he fell in love with baseball, the same day I fell in love with baseball, October 9th, 1966. A marvelous story for the underdog Baltimore Orioles.
Now, the 60s were a great start as an organization for the Orioles, but it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows and happy endings. In 1969, they were on the opposite end of the spectrum when they came in as the favorite, a heavy favorite, over the, who would eventually be dubbed as, Miracle Mets. Can you tell us about that dynamic and how it was different?
The Orioles were the favorites because the Orioles were awesome. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. With a late slide at the end of the regular season, they still won 109 games and lost 50. 53. That's higher than a 667 percentage. 109-53. And we were all mad in Baltimore because for the first time, we were now going to have to jump through a hoop to get to the World Series. This was the introduction of the American League Championship Series. And yes, 10-year-old Charles, almost 11, gets to go to the first ever American League Championship Series game. I still see it. Mezzanine seats, yellow seats, and Boog Powell hits a line drive game-tying home run in the bottom of the 10th. And how did we win the game? On a two-out, two-strike suicide squeeze by Paul Blair, a great bunter, that brought in Mark Belanger, and we won the first game ever. Many, 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 many years later, I'm with Paul Blair. I said, how did you have the guts to do a suicide squeeze with two outs and two strikes? He said, I couldn't hit. I was in a slump. I was in a slump I couldn't get out of for the life of me. One thing I could do was bunt. It's the only weapon I had. And we beat the Twins game two. We beat the Twins game three. Justice prevails. The 109-53 Orioles sweep the Twins. And all we have to do now are face the amazing Mets. We didn't think they were going to be amazing. How many games had they won that year? Something in the 80s. Not 90s. And not 109-53. And Uncle Stanley Steinbeck, my father's friend and later my physician, got to take me to game one of the 69 World Series. They weren't just bleacher seats. They were additional bleachers that were added in front of the right field bleachers. And if you go watch that game, in the bottom of the first inning, Don Buford from the Orioles hits a home run right into those right field bleachers. It didn't come that far away. And how exciting was that? And we went on, I think we won that game 4-1. And obviously we were going to beat the New York Mets. I mean, yes, they had Tom Seaver, who was the comparable pitcher to Jim Palmer. And yes, they had Jerry Kuzman, who was the comparable pitcher to Dave McNally. And yes, they had Gary Gentry, who might be, well, I think I would take our chances on Mike Cuellar over him. And then they had this young guy nobody really had ever heard of. He wasn't big yet. His name was Nolan Ryan. He didn't even make the top three.
That's ridiculous.
And I'm not at game two in Baltimore, and we lose. But the Mets are making miraculous plays. Now the team goes to New York, and those miraculous plays continue. Tommy Agee, Ron Swoboda, who was a Baltimorean, by the way, playing for the Mets. And now, suddenly, we're down 3-1. Wait a minute. We're the Baltimore Orioles. We won 109-53. And in, I think it was in game five, that Earl Weaver insisted that J.C. Martin ran out of the baseline and threw a legendary Earl Weaver tantrum, one of the early ones in what would be a Hall of Fame career of great tantrums. And the Mets won. And they won the World Series. And we were stunned. Yes, they were the underdogs. We were the overdogs. We were 109-53. Of course you think we're going to win the World Series. But just remember, the Dodgers thought they were going to win the World Series in 1966. One of the most beautiful attributes of baseball is the game's insistence that you be humbled. If you think you've got it figured out, the game will prove to you that you don't know squat. There is an expression in baseball called the reverse lock, L-O-C-K. And it's a mandatory phrase for understanding, because Jim Palmer's going to pitch against some journeyman that you've never heard of who's just wandered team to team. And you'll say, oh, it's a lock that we're going to win this game. After all, it's Jim Palmer against what's his name? Baseball has a fascinating way of delivering the reverse lock. When it is so one-sided that you are sure you've got it figured out, beware of the reverse lock. It goes the other way. It can be a freakish play. It can be that the game goes extra innings. Remember, a starting pitcher has to have his team score a run to win. So the underdog is an active part of baseball, always. The worst teams are going to win a third of their games. This could be the day they win. Everybody's going to win 54. Everybody's going to lose 54. Is what happens to the middle 54. And when you're great, like those 69 Orioles, you even only lost 53. But they were going up against a team that in a short series beat them. The underdog won. The amazing Mets of 69. And the manager of that team, a hero of the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Shades of Ipswich Town in the 60s, Nottingham Forest in the 70s. But this is unique. A modern day football miracle. They have blown their rivals away. They have blown us all away, in truth. Premier League champions 2016. The amazing Leicester City!
Been around the block in baseball. You've seen the unbelievable, the unfathomable.
I'm in suspense. Go on.
What is the all-time moment for you? What would you consider to be the poster child for the underdog?
The underdog poster child, I'll tell you briefly, because that's not the story I'm going to tell you. The underdog poster child has to be the Boston Red Sox of 2004, being down 3-0. In that third game, we lost 19-8 to the New York Yankees in the ALCS. And if anyone thought we were going to come back and win 4 straight and then win 4 more, I ascribe to them the responsibility of being evangelists because they believed. I didn't believe. That's the greatest comeback you can imagine. However, I experienced something else that bears storytelling. Those Baltimore Orioles were great. 66, 69, won the World Series in 70, won the pennant in 71, won the division title in 73, 74. They never drew phenomenal crowds. In fact, the slogan in 1974, after getting to the ALCS in 73, was a million or more in 74. It was a little bit embarrassing, in fact, that we didn't sell out the 1971 World Series. We held 53,000. We drew 48,000. But something, well, to use a phrase that would become part of Baltimore's vernacular, something magic happened. The 1977 Orioles were decimated by this new concept of free agency. We lost Reggie Jackson. You didn't even know he played for us. We lost Bobby Gritch. We lost a 20-game winner, Wayne Garland. Expectations couldn't have been lower for the 77 team, a team that had 8 rookies. But those 8 rookies could play, and they knew they could play. And they had a very good year, finished 2.5 games out. One key player, Al Bumbry, broke his leg in 78, and the team still won 90 games. But finished 4th. But in 1979, those rookies were now in their 3rd year, and they were ready, and they were great. and they were the kings of the comeback. A fascinating, well, there's so many fascinating games I can tell you one by one. Coming back against the Red Sox in May, coming back against the Texas Rangers on Sunday, June 10th. And the crowd was realizing this team never gives up. This team never quits. And there we were in Baltimore on a Friday night in June. Double check it. I'm going to say June 23rd, whatever the Friday was. We're playing the Detroit Tigers. And we had a big crowd for one good reason. We were giving out Oriole tankards, mugs. And when you gave out a good Oriole mug, you got a great crowd. And it was a loud crowd. Maybe they were using their mugs. But we were losing. We're down 5-3 in the bottom of the ninth. But this crowd had been taught by the players not to give up. And the crowd went into the bottom of the ninth roaring. And Ken Singleton hits a home run, and it's 5-4. And Lee May gets a hit. And Doug DeCinse comes up facing a guy whose name would go in the annals of Orioles lore named Dave Tobik. And the crowd is on its feet cheering as though we have won. We're losing. It's 5-4. I think there's one out, which means a double play and the game's over. We lose. But the crowd was roaring as though they were willing the team to win, as though their energy was going to change the outcome of the game, as though their energy was going to be as profound an influence as a player. And with the crowd on its feet, roaring, down 5-4, thwack! And here is this long drive to deep left field, and their passion is rewarded. Their faith is rewarded as Doug DeCinse hits a two-run homer. And in delirium, we win that game. All day, the next day, our radio station, that year was their first time as our radio station, WFPR, played that call. Over and over and over. They were setting our highlights to rock and roll songs. You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. A whole bunch of them. We had the biggest walk-up for that Saturday twi-night doubleheader that we had ever had. And what happened? In game one, the game goes into extra innings. It is 5-5. And in the top of the 10th, I believe, the Tigers get a run. It's 6-5. And that called for the crowd to go into action. And in the bottom of the 10th, they're cheering as though we've won. Yet we're going to lose. We're down 6-5. But nobody thought we were going to lose because the crowd was becoming a player. And we get two men on for Eddie Murray, one of those rookies in 77. Now, this is the day after the night before. Thwack! A three-run homer. We win 8-6. And the crowd, for the second night in a row, has been validated for the emotional expense of standing and cheering, the risking, the spending of emotional capital, believing. Hey, there's still a game two to play. And in a come-from-behind game in the bottom of the eighth inning, we win that one too. That weekend is the weekend that Orioles magic was born. That was when the crowd learned, the fans learned, that they matter, that they contribute, that their presence and their ovation is an influence in the game. It was a lesson Baltimore learned that June weekend in 1979, and it made being the underdog a badge of honor. Watch what happens when we're down. It was a lesson that fans of the Boston Red Sox had learned long ago. They had learned it more than 75 years earlier when Boston's Royal Rooters, in the first ever World Series, were rooting for their team, who was down. Now, the first World Series was 5 out of 9, not 4 out of 7. And they're down 4-1. And the Royal Rooters go into action, relentlessly taunting the Pirates with the singing of the Broadway song Tessie, with made-up lyrics. And Boston wins the first ever World Series. And the fans of Boston learned in 1903 what the fans of Baltimore learned in 1979. And it's one of the most beautiful forms of ecstasy in baseball, when a city learns that the city positively influences the outcome of the game, and the underdog becomes the champion. And those Orioles won the 1979 pennant.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Charles Steinberg, for coming on to the Underpod and talking to me about your passion, and for what it's worth, my passion too. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Baseball is a game of stories, story makers, storytellers. It's a great blessing we have. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to tell these stories.
Of course, there's nobody better in the industry than telling stories. So we will have you on anytime, Dr. Charles, that is for sure. We will be right back with our best in show before we wrap up for the week. But first, a word from our sponsor, Big Faith Barbecue. Big Faith Barbecue is running a special this week. Come on down to Boylston Street in Brookline, where Big Faith Barbecue is running a smoked meat special all week. That means brisket, ribs, pulled pork, and more. All for you, all for a discounted price. And that comes along with their famous sides. Mac and cheese, coleslaw, Texas toast, take your pick. Just make sure you come down today to Big Faith Barbecue and you pick yourself up some of her famous smoked meats. And while you're at it, you can get some of her famous dipping sauces to go with it. And it's a match made in heaven that will make any family dinner a spicy affair. Big Faith Barbecue in Brookline. Come on down. Now, before we let y'all go, we have to do our second installment of our weekly event, Best in Show. This week, the players we're highlighting for our Best in Show are the Robinsons, Brooks and Frank. Charles Steinberg will tell you, and he will fight to the mat with this opinion, that Brooks Robinson is the best third baseman in baseball history. That is an argument that can be substantiated with years of stats. The year they won the 1966 World Series, he was the All-Star Game MVP and a Gold Glover, and had what some call the best defensive World Series of all time. That year he batted nearly .270 with 23 home runs and exactly 100 RBIs with 167 hits, and played all but 5 games that season. His namesake in the outfield, Frank Robinson, was traded for in the offseason prior, as Dr. Charles Steinberg said, and not only did he go on to lead the team and lead them to a World Series title, but he also won baseball's Triple Crown that year. He led the AL in average with a .316, he led in home runs with 49 and RBIs with 122. He racked up 182 hits and played all but 7 games in the season before capping it off with a ring. Tune in every week and we will give you the best in show for each and every story, sponsored by Purina One. That's going to do it here for the Underpod this week. Join us next week as we sit down with Steven Gerrard, manager of Aston Villa and former Liverpool player, as we talk about the 2006 Champions League final, that night in Istanbul, that immortalized Steven Gerrard and his Liverpool captaincy in world football history. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at UnderPodShow and tune in every Wednesday in the morning for a new episode of the UnderPod. Until next week, remember, always Team David, never Team Goliath. Thank y'all and have a good week.